Deadbeat Scroll by Mark Coggins is slick, sardonic, and suspenseful. Everything a great thriller should be, says New York Times bestselling author Lee Child. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 28. Gather Round the Campfire. Again with the Little Debbie banana pudding rolls, Ray? We were parked in his Dodge Aries on Hyde Street, across from the intersection with Russell Street. It was about 9:20 p.m., and in lieu of the perfectly good McDonald's meal I'd offered to buy him, he was now compulsively unwrapping and shoving into his face lard-infused sponge cake rolls covered in squiggles of icing that he took from a box on the seat between us. The last time I'd watched him engage in this particular brand of self-toxification had also been on a stakeout. It seemed to be a pattern.
"No worse than that double quarter pounder with cheese you ate," Ray said in a voice wheezy with pudding roll.
"You ever heard of yellow dye number 5? That's known to cause hyperactivity in children. Those things are loaded with it."
"Yeah, I know. At my age, I could use a little hyperactivity."
He had a point, but he and I had actually been quite active since our meeting with Gretchen. We had retrieved Ray's copy of the scroll from the storage unit, taken it to 29 Russell Street, threaded past the crime scene tape to the second floor landing, and photographed it with my cell phone, being sure to leave suggestive bits of the surrounding background visible in the picture. Then I had texted the photos to Brendan along with a message demanding to set up a meeting for the exchange as soon as possible. It turned out that the camera app on my phone had been set to incorporate EXIF, and we left it in the photos we sent. Brendan responded with a smug message indicating he was satisfied with the proofs we offered. That wasn't surprising, as Ray's scroll did look very convincing. The only things he hadn't been able to replicate were the foxing on the paper and the yellowing, brittle scotch tape. Brendan followed with a proposed meeting time at 9 the next morning at a location he would text me 30 minutes beforehand. His reply was so facile and lacking in details that I became convinced that the whole thing was a trick, as Ray had suggested. I agreed to the plan in any case. To finish baiting our trap, we put the scroll in an old toolbox and wedged the box between a pair of studs on the landing, as if it had been left behind by a member of the construction crew. But the duplicate scroll wasn't the only thing we left behind. Ray mounted a battery-powered video camera high on another stud that provided a wide-angle view of the whole landing and some of the steps approaching it. The camera was part of the gear Ray used for his one true passion in life, model airplanes, and it could transmit a wireless signal to a monitor up to 5 miles away. We weren't anywhere near 5 miles away, of course. We were just a half block up the street. Ray had a computer tablet receiving the live feed from the camera next to the Little Debbie box. So far, the only thing of interest we'd seen on the feed was a stray cat prowling up the stairs to sniff at the toolbox, his eyes glowing in the special low-light camera like a demon's. In spite of my admonition, Ray tossed the wrapper of the previous Little Debbie pudding roll over his shoulder and rummaged in the box for another. "You might want to press the pause button on your Little Debbie binge," I said, nodding at the SUV with tinted windows that was trying to park in front of the converted condos across the way. If I had any doubts that the car contained Andreas and Brendan, they were erased when the driver obsessively reversed and pulled forward in the spot to get the car positioned just so, even though he was working with a good 3 feet of room on either side. Andreas, the anal-retentive heist driver. Ray flipped over the tablet so the telltale glow from the screen wouldn't light up the interior of the Aries, and we both hunched as low as we could on the old bench seat. It was unnecessary effort. Brendan rolled out of the car like the potentate of a prosperous kleptocracy, oblivious to his surroundings. Andreas fell in behind him, clutching a tablet computer of his own, and they ambled up Russell Street, alternatively checking house numbers and glancing at the tablet.
"They're using the computer to confirm the GPS coordinates," Ray said.
"Yeah, I got that. But it shouldn't be that much of a mystery. They've been there before, when they murdered Angelina's sister. You'd think it would have left an impression." Ray shrugged.
"They are psychopathic killers, true, but they are conscientious psychopathic killers."
"I'm pretty sure that's worse."
"Probably."
Ray turned our tablet computer over to monitor the feed, but we picked up the sounds of their approach on the camera's microphone before we saw them. A board on the stairs squeaked, and Andreas said,
"Upstairs? Where the body was? Isn't that a little dramatic?"
Brendan chuckled, and the top of his head became visible.
"That's where I'm betting. Given his limited intelligence, he probably thought this was the last place in the world we would check, or that we would be deterred by the crime scene tape."
Both men came fully into view as they trudged up the rickety stairs, Brendan's torso gray and wavering in the ambient light, and Andreas's blown out by the glare from his computer's display. A step shy of the landing, Brendan pointed at the toolbox on the floor between the studs.
"Hey, shine some light over there."
Andreas came up beside him and fiddled with the tablet, projecting a white-hot beam from a corner of the device.
"It's a toolbox."
"As if any competent demo crew would leave their tools around to be stolen. That has to be it."
Brendan hurried up to the box and kneeled on the bare boards to open it.
"Bingo," he said with a new urgency in his voice. "What a cretin. It's almost too easy."
Andreas squatted beside him, pouring the tablet's light over the scroll.
"Are you sure? Not another fake?"
Brendan feverishly unspooled the scroll, taking care not to let any part of it touch the floor.
"Yes, yes," he mumbled to himself as he went, interjecting, "My God, it's genius!" and "What beautiful writing!"
when he came to passages he particularly liked. After running through almost the whole thing, Brendan slumped back on his haunches with a sigh.
"What did I tell you? This is it! We have the full manuscript."
"Dottie knows best," said Andreas
without the slightest trace of irony.
"Damn right. But Reardon wasn't a worthy opponent. Nothing like Duckworth. Duckworth was a different story."
"Yes, he was."
Ray glanced up from our tablet.
"That's three times they've insulted your intelligence."
"Sure, but who's counting?"
"Time for your little chore. They'll be heading back to the car soon."
"Nah, they'll be patting themselves on the back for another 20 minutes. But I opened the glove box as I spoke and extracted another of the gizmos Ray had adapted from his model airplane hobby, a small GPS tracking device. "Where's the best place?"
"The tailpipe."
"Really? It won't get burned up?"
"No. I've got a special heat shield around it, and the tailpipe is less likely to be checked in the wheel well or under the bumper."
Well, since Brendan prides himself so much on being a top, there is a certain irony in shoving this up his tailpipe. Ray made a face.
"Please, August, you need to be more respectful of my generation's sensibilities."
"Right," I said, leavening the word with irony. I popped the passenger's door on the old Dodge and hustled across the street to the back of the SUV, where I deployed the mission payload, griming my fingers with carbon in spite of the care I took. I stood and waited for a slug of traffic to pass, then jogged back to the Ares, where I resumed my seat beside Ray. "Anything interesting happened while I was gone?"
"Nothing you want to hear about, except they've repacked the scroll in the toolbox and are already heading down the stairs. They seem to be in a hurry now that they've won the prize."
Sure enough, it wasn't a minute before we saw the pair of them hot-footing it down Russell Street, their long shadows under the streetlight stabbing ahead of them as they went. The parking lights on the SUV flashed as Andreas unlocked the doors remotely, and Brendan dove into the back seat with the toolbox clamped to his middle as if it were a football. Andreas got into the driver's seat, started the car, and pulled out onto Hyde with reckless abandon, for him at least. Ray had returned to the tablet computer as soon as we saw them approach, and he had switched from the camera stream to an app that showed a map of San Francisco with a deep blue background. "Your doohickey working?" Ray touched a menu at the corner of the screen and made a selection. A flashing dot appeared at our location on the map.
"Yes, my doohickey is working. We can safely tail them from a mile or two back."
We'd had the inevitable argument about who was going to drive, so I was relieved to hear that my decision to let Ray get behind the wheel wasn't going to be tested by the requirement to do a close-up tail. "Okay," I said, picking up the tablet. "I'll call out the directions so you can devote your full attention to keeping all four wheels in contact with the road," and pointed in the right direction.
"Piece of cake,"
Ray said, and fired up the Aries, holding the key in the start position a second too long, so the flywheel ground with a noise like a shovel scraping asphalt.
"Sorry,"
he mumbled. Off to a flying start. "They're still on Hyde heading south, so you need to do a U-ey." Ray did a creditable job of executing a three-point turn, using the mouth of Russell Street for extra maneuvering room and only getting honked at by oncoming traffic once, as we rumbled down the gently sloping road with the cable car tracks directly beneath us. I checked the tablet and saw the flashing dot turning off Hyde. "They're turning left onto Golden Gate about a mile ahead."
"What's that mean?"
"Too early to tell. They could be heading for one of the freeways."
"You think they're leaving town?"
"I hope not. This is going to be a lot harder if we have to ambush them on the road. But I don't think so. We know there are more members of the family. If they did drive here, there are other vehicles, and they'll want a rendezvous before they head up to Vancouver. Remember, they think they've outsmarted us. They've got plenty of time."
"But what if they're going to the airport? How do we—"
"Ray, just drive. We'll deal with it when we deal with it." He grunted and said nothing more. We followed them onto Golden Gate Avenue, but by the time we got there, they had already turned south onto 6th Street. I was pretty sure they were heading for the freeway, since 6 feeds directly into the on-ramp for Highway 280 South. Unless Brendan and Andreas were badly confused, that eliminated driving north to Canada, but still left the airport as a possibility. We crossed Market Street and rolled down 6, passing a number of SRO residential hotels, many of them with homeless people huddled in the gloom by the entrances. Andreas did as I expected and got on Highway 280 South, but I delayed telling Ray to avoid another what-if discussion. There were still plenty of San Francisco exits on the freeway they would have to pass before we would know if they were leaving town.
"The freeway,"
Ray said as he stared at the looming on-ramp from the stoplight at 6th and Brannan.
"I was right. They're going to the airport."
"You're right about the freeway, but they've already gotten off."
"Where?"
"The 25th Street exit into Bayview, Hunter's Point, but they're still going." Ray floored the Aries, provoking a crescendo of knocking and pinging, but the car barely accelerated. As Ray wheezed slowly up the elevated on-ramp, I watched as Andreas executed a series of quick turns over the course of less than a mile. He went east onto Cesar Chavez, then south on 3rd, then veered southeast on Cargo Way, and finally took a couple of hard lefts onto Jennings in the street called Amador, where he stopped. I didn't know Amador, but the map told me it was very close to the bay near the old Pier 96, which had been converted from a dock to a recycling center. Ray drove on 280 to the exit for 25th and followed the same circuitous route to where Amador intersected with Jennings. The area was thoroughly industrial, with a rail yard to the left and a rock crushing plant to the right, and it was dark, very dark. The tablet computer told me that Andreas had stopped another half mile ahead, surprisingly close to the point where Amador bent back to an intersection with Cargo Way. Unless he had gotten lost, I wasn't sure why he hadn't taken the more direct route from Cargo to his destination.
"Well, what now?"
Ray asked as we idled on the shoulder of the road. "They've stopped just ahead. I don't want to go barreling up in this squeaky tub with the lights blazing and give ourselves away. We get out and walk, but at some point you're going to have to hang back and let me handle it."
"I brought a gun."
"What? You brought a gun after giving me so much crap about sending me the Luger?" I pressed my elbow on the holster next to my ribs to feel the gun's reassuring bulk. "Where'd you get it?"
"Where do you think? From a gun store."
"Okay. I'm not going to say I'm sorry you have it, but you still have to hang back if I tell you."
"With pleasure."
Ray killed the lights and turned off the car, and we stepped out into the night. It was cool and damp so close to the bay, and there was an unpleasant, almost tar-like tang to the air, most likely a carcinogenic solvent from one of the industrial yards, I reassured myself. We debated taking the tablet computer with us, but after watching Andreas and Brendan blunder around Russell Street with one, we decided the risk of their leaving the area without us knowing was outweighed by the risk of the light from the computer giving us away. We trudged along the chain-link fence topped by razor wire that bounded the rock-crushing operation. At a curve where the road bent back toward Cargo Way, the fence ended, and we came upon a tall steel tower painted orange and white. It had a single flashing light on the top, but it seemed an odd place for a transmission tower. Ray noticed me staring.
"Aircraft warning light," he whispered.
I nodded, and we continued past a cement plant with mixers parked by the gate. Past that were warehouses and several honest-to-goodness trees, which looked as out of place as gazebos in the ninth circle of hell. Approaching the location where Andreas must have parked, we passed railroad cars on a siding and a cluster of storage tanks. Up ahead, we saw an abandoned grain elevator with more than a dozen silos. There were tiny windows around the top of the silos, and the surface of the concrete walls was mottled and cracked with age. A decrepit chain-link fence surrounded the structure, but as I came up to the gate, I could see that there was no lock in the hasp. Standing quietly on the cracked, weed-infiltrated asphalt by the gate, I heard a low rumble of male voices and a higher lilt of female laughter coming from beyond. A flickering light emanated from behind the grain elevator, but it was impossible to tell whether it came from inside the building or from a source in the yard that was blocked from my view. I took hold of Ray's sleeve and pulled him closer. "This is where you hang back. If you hear shouts or shooting, use your discretion. If you see them drive out again, go back to the car and track them. Then alert Gretchen and call 911.
"Those are a bunch of swell options."
"Don't worry. They've boxed themselves in here, and they aren't expecting us. If I can, I'm going to disable their vehicles first, and then we'll have our little tete-a-tete."
"Godspeed, John Glenn."
"Thanks." I lifted the hasp on the gate and pulled it open a foot or so, then slid through. I moved quickly to the side of the grain elevator and poked my head around the corner. A motorhome was parked head-in towards the building. Squatting, I could make out the wheels of another vehicle parked beyond the motorhome. The SUV, I assumed. I slipped the Luger out of its holster, snicked off the safety, and crept up to the side of the motorhome. Its front bumper was nearly touching the wall of the grain elevator, and as I crouched by the front wheel, I came face-to-face with big-tooth animal graffiti spray-painted on the walls by somebody who styled himself Chili Dog. I was tempted to let the air out of all the tires of the motorhome, but the voices were louder here, and I was both worried I would be overheard and curious to know what was going on. In one of the most foolhardy moves I made in a long career of foolhardy moves, I got down on my belly and combat crawled under the RV. I snaked myself over to the front wheel on the other side and peered around the edge closest to the grain elevator. There was a gap of about 8 inches, and I could see a large opening in the building. In front of it sat some sort of gas fire pit in a ceramic bowl, the source of the light I'd seen earlier. Sitting around the fire pit were 4 or 5 people. I could see the feet of 2 of them, and I heard 2 or 3 more on the other side of the pit.
"There's no rush," said a voice I recognized as Brendan's. "Midday is soon enough. After all, no one is coming after us, and that would still give us time to get across the Oregon border by nightfall. We can use the morning to take care of a couple of final items. One is sending Reardon a text to confirm the time and place for the fictitious exchange, even though he no longer has anything to trade in return for our fair Bridget. Ha ha!"
Our fair Bridget? Who the hell was Bridget? It took me a moment to figure it out, but the implication hit me with a sickening vertigo. Lying flat on my belly on the grimy asphalt beneath the motorhome, I felt like I was spinning out of control, cold sweat popping from every pore.
"The other thing we need to do is dispose of the guns. All of them. I don't know what possessed you and Jeff to go rogue, Bridget, but a ballistics test on your weapons would implicate us in the worst of the murders. No one cares if a drug-addicted whore and a desiccated pimptress die, but the others, well, that's a different story. You hear me?"
"Yes, Daddy,"
said Angelina. You have been listening to The Deadbeat Scroll, a book the New York Journal of Books described as a glorious potpourri of violence, black humor, sex, and a hunt for a lost manuscript. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.